Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's December 9th, 2011, and you're listening to the best poker cast on the internet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Omaha Long. So you're supposed to do Chris Stud 8.
Oh, Cosenza. I'm sorry.
You missed the cue there.
Yes, I went to Connecticut. I just got back last night, and I did play a little Stud 8. I won a little in Connecticut at Foxwoods.
Connecticut in December.
Yes, isn't it beautiful up there?
Everybody dreams of that.
It's funny because, you know, my stepson Charles came along with us too, and the reason he came is because he was hoping to be able to go somewhere and snowboard. And that didn't happen, so he wasn't happy about that. And it wasn't warm, but it wasn't cold enough to. It was cold enough to tick me off for being there, but it wasn't warm enough for me to be like, "Hey, this isn't that bad." So I was not happy about it. But I did make my my usual trek to Foxwoods, and I sat down with the tournament director there, Jeffrey Toth. Great guy. I talked to him a couple of times now up there, and you know, before I went up there, it's real interesting too. Before I went up there, I came up with this really. What I thought would be kind of a cool idea for a poker tournament, and trademark pending. So I ran it by you, and I was like, what do you think? You're like, oh, we're going to wait for the show. I said, okay. So I was doing this. I think I was compiling results, and it was for one of the tournaments up north, and they had this really large bounty tournament where like the buy-in was like 1,000, and the bounty was like 500 or something. And I thought, wow, that was huge. I said, why not have the ultimate bounty tournament. That's what we'll call it, the ultimate bounty, where
it can be hosted by Dog the Bounty Hunter.
That's right, Dog. Dog and his, what's that haircut he has? That
mullet.
Long, yeah, mullet mane thing, whatever it is he's got going on there. But really, I thought, why not have an ultimate bounty? Whereas there are no prize pool. And you just, when you knock somebody out, you get their entire entry. And it's like
interesting.
The whole playing, you know, strategy goes out the window. I mean, now you're just playing to knock people out, and you know, I can imagine the strategy now. A lot of people would get involved. If you cripple somebody, everybody gets involved. When that person's in a hand, it's not just about eliminating them to make the money. Now you're eliminating them to make actual money,
right?
And I just felt like that would be like so mano a mano kind of thing, and. You know, I mean, it's...
I don't speak French.
It's exactly the opposite of, like, a super satellite, where you're just hoping to squeak in and everybody gets paid the same amount. No, this is, you know, you keep tallying people, you know, you're making money. You knock one person out, you got your money back. You got, knock one person out, you get your money back.
Well, minus the raking.
Well, all right, so knock two people out and you're making significant profit.
Fees.
But, I mean, really, you know, I mean, to me, that's... You know, you play in a 500 plus 50, and you knock somebody out, you're happy to get that 500 back, and now you're almost free-rolling for the rest of the tournament. Oh, the I would just imagine that the strategy would be just incredible. There are so many ways to look at the way to play this. And before I tell you what Jeff told me, I just want to see what you think of that.
I love it.
Isn't it a cool idea?
It is a cool idea. Here's my one question. I'm sure you've had this figured out, or Jeff figured it out for you. When you knock another player out, you just get that one bounty, right?
Right.
You don't get all their bounty chips like some bounty tournaments.
Right. No, you just get their one bounty chip, and no one can get it from you. That's yours. That's your money.
Okay. So when you knock them out, they'll give you like a cash chip or something, and
yeah.
And then when you get knocked out, all right, that's cool. Then I think I like it.
Now here's what, and I knew that someone much more smarter than me would douse this flame of passion I have for this, but so what happened was he was talking about they had a tournament at Foxwoods where it was a 100-100 plus, you know, whatever it was, plus 20 or whatever. So, yeah, you paid $200 to get in, but there was a $100 bounty in everybody's head.
It's kind of like half the ultimate bounty tournament.
Yeah, it was half
like
ultimate.
The ult bounty tournament.
Or the mate. Let's play mate bounty. And he said they were expecting maybe 200, and they got over 400 people for it.
Wow.
And he couldn't believe it. I mean, they had he was telling me, too, that they have five sets of tournament chips at Foxwoods. One's for, like, sit-and-goes, one's for, like, the really big main event, and then the two's for another big main event, and then the other two for the dailies or whatever. So they literally have five, and they had so many people in this one tournament, they had to use, like, two. They had to mix sets.
Oh, wow.
To get them all. Yeah, it was that many people. So then I said, I can't believe you're saying this. And he's like, why? I said, because I was just about, this week on the show, we're going to talk about the ultimate bounty, the tournament I invented. And I invented it, because I'm sure someone's probably tried this. I haven't seen any of our results or anything. I know the Borgata does a really big purple chip one or something where it's a $500 bounty, but I don't think there's always a prize pool. And this would be no prize pool. So what he said to me was, well, it's the paperwork, buddy. And I'm like, what? He said, it's the paperwork and it's the money. He said, I don't know if we'd be comfortable with that kind of money having our dealers or our floor people responsible for passing out chips, because they use real denomination. So if you play $100, they give you a black chip, and it's a real cash value chip. And I was like, well, couldn't you like assign it to like a Lammer or, you know, some sort of placard or something? And he was like, yeah, but even then, you know, in the tournament area, they don't have money. They have like slips and things like that downstairs in the cashiers. So he went on a little bit about that, saying that really they'd be responsible for so much money. If you got 200 people and it's a $1,000 buy-in, you got $200,000 in cash that they're like throwing around the table, you know. So, but I was like, but if they're just, you know, bounty chips and they have to go downstairs to the cashier, so then he's like, yeah, well, I mean, that's an interesting way of doing it. And then he said, but then it's the paperwork too. I guess there's a lot of, to have to do it that way, you'd have to submit for it and whatever. But he was pretty intrigued by it. I don't know if maybe he was playing his cards close to the vest and he might actually try it now that I've said it. I don't know.
Well, but he brings up a good point that us mere mortals often forget, is that it's not so much just the room trying to find a way to make it work within their own internal controls, but you know, a lot of states, and it sounds like Foxwoods is one of them, or Connecticut's one of them, you know, you have to clear any tournament that you're doing with the State Gaming Commission and explain to them how it's going to work. And, you know, anytime you got to get them involved, it becomes a much bigger headache than it needs to be.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably what he's getting at. You know, I think for us rogue poker room operators like the Andy of Poker Cruise, where we don't have to worry about clearing it with anyone but our poker room manager, it probably could work.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's some rooms in some states, too, where they don't have to do all that kind of approval. In fact, actually, I don't think here in Florida you have to get tournament formats approved like you do in some states. So then at that point, it just becomes, you know, how you hand it internally. And I think you're right. You could do Lammers.
Yeah.
But, you know, it depends on how much money's involved with stuff, too. I could see that being, you know, even though it's a Lammer, I mean, it's still like a $100 chip that's sitting in the dealer tray.
Yeah.
Or, you know, having your floor come around and you know, dole them out. And then that takes a lot of floor time. But I think the other paperwork, too, I think would be interesting is when you turn your Lammers in, and I think they'd have to do this. I think this is why they'd have to do Lammers rather than chips, because I think you have the IRS reporting.
Yeah.
You know, if you win enough that you have to report like you would in a normal tournament, then you have to be able to fill out that paperwork. So I think it'd have to be Lammers for that reason. And imagine that. I mean, right now in a tournament, you know, maybe 10 people have to fill out IRS paperwork. But in this tournament, you know, if it's a highly competitive tournament and people are pretty even, you get a lot of people filling out paperwork.
Yeah. Yeah, that could be, and that's probably what he was getting at, too, is just it'd be a nightmare to do IRS and for 14, 15 people per tournament or something, you know. But, I mean, you do it for big tournaments, too. I mean, if you look at, if it's 5,000 or more, you know, you're playing in the World Series, those World Series guys are all doing IRS stuff. So, I mean, if you're prepared for it and you've done it once and you've got it all in a good system, it might be kind of fun, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, or if it's a lower bounty tournament where it's a $50 tournament entry fee, you'd have to win a lot of Lammers to...
Right.
You know, to do it. So it might be worth it. I don't know. But I had a lot of fun with it, and there'll be more about my talk with him on next week's show, too. We've got some other stuff to talk about. But it was fun. Had a good time. I wish I could have stayed longer. I waited so long to play Set 8 that I only got to play for a little while and then had to leave. So, but it was fun, and I really enjoyed myself. So you and I both were playing pretty much at the same time. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I probably really shouldn't have because I'm getting ready for the poker cruise here this week. but I just couldn't pass up the fact that I could play a Limit Omaha 8 World Poker Tour event in my backyard.
Yeah.
Seminole Hard Rock is having their first World Poker Tour series this week, and it's you know, one of their new regional things that WPT does, so it's not the big kahuna with TVs and stuff like that. But still, it's, you know, the WPT brand, and yep. And I was just happy, to be honest, to be able to play a Limit 08 tournament here in Tampa. I mean, we can't even get games going here. So I'm like, you know, I got to go over and play it. I don't know when I'm getting another chance to do this. And did it and got there, and I was figuring, you know, hey, it'd be 40, 50 people playing this thing. Because, you know, every month you send me the pages to proof for the magazine, and I read through it, and, you know, you go through the results of these big tournament series, and I look at the number of entries, and it's like 300, 350, 400, 250. And then you can see Omaha 8 event, 40.
Yeah. I know, it's crazy.
So I get there, and I was talking to the manager and his boss for a while, and at some point I wasn't paying attention. It was before the tournament started, but they looked up, and they're like, yeah, we're at 130 entrants right now. I bet you we're going to get $150. I looked up, I'm like, oh, my gosh. It ended with 157 entries. I'm sure there's larger 08 tournaments that have been around, but, I mean, that is easily three times more than I thought this tournament was going to draw. Two times more than my most optimistic thing. And that was great to see it come out. And so we continued to talk about it a little bit. And I said, particularly here in Florida, where we barely can get cash games going for Omaha.
Yeah.
It's really impressive. So we talked a little bit more, and the manager told me that about 3 months ago, he added a monthly Omaha 8 Limit event to his normal tournament schedule. So they did it once a month on a Sunday, and he specifically did it to kind of get the prime the pump, as it is, and get people comfortable playing those tournaments and building it up. And he said he's had 80 or so in it every time since then. So to me, I think here's an example, you know, when managers, it's easy for managers to say, we can't schedule those tournaments. No one plays them. It's not worth our time. We'll make a lot more money doing the Limit. I totally agree with them. But here's some evidence, I think, that if you actually put some effort into it, you might be able to get an event that works. And people loved it. People that played it absolutely loved it. And we're glad they had it. And it was a good time.
It's eerily similar to last year with the Palm Beach Kennel Club's horse event that we played in.
That's true.
Remember, he said the same thing. He had gotten the horse tournament to go once a month or whatever to get people ready for it. Certainly worked out that way. 170-something entered that tournament. And,
that's right.
And it worked out. So I think that it's proof positive. You know, one is a, you know, what is it? One is an anomaly, but two is a trend, and there you go. I mean, if it works, it works. So great work by them, and great that you had that many entrants. That must have been cool looking out and seeing all those people playing Omaha. It's kind of like when I go to a Rush concert, you know? I'm with all the people that like Rush. It's like I find nobody likes Rush when I'm walking down the street, and they all think I'm weird. But when I'm at a concert, I feel so embraced. It's like, oh, they all think like me, you know? Same with you.
The best part is when the dealers shuffled in, you know, at the end of their down. They're like, oh, Omaha. They look up at the clock, you know, so they can check the blinds and make sure they're doing, like, 157 entrants. Like, wow, I didn't know there were that many Omaha players in this area. So they were all impressed. And actually, one of them made a really good point, I thought. He thought the buy-in was very perfectly priced. It was a $200 event plus a $20 dealer add-on. Someone said because it's cheap. And he's like, no, because it's $200.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, most people aren't going to get out of bed for a $100 tournament, but a $200 tournament is enough to get them here. And the $200 is low enough that you're going to get some of those no-limit players that are going to be willing to try it out and give it a whirl. So I think there's some genius to that as well, too. I didn't really think about it, but, I mean, $200 was the perfect amount for me. I wouldn't want to pay more than that. I certainly would have paid less, but, I mean, you don't want to come to an Omaha event expecting 40 people and it's a $100 buy-in and play all day for $2,000 top prize, you know.
Yeah.
But they had 157. I outlasted, I think, 149. I think I finished 48th. That's what the little clock on the wall said, and I kind of counted to just be sure I couldn't lie and say 47, but 48. But I had a good run. Didn't get any cards, but had a blast playing. But a couple interesting things that came up while we were talking at the table. Obviously, it's an Omaha event, so always there's interesting stuff that comes up.
Yeah.
The very first level, players at the table were talking, and they were asking the dealer, you know, hey, if we get heads up in a hand, are there unlimited raises? And so, of course, the dealer, a well-trained dealer, asked the floor to come over to answer, and the floor came over and said, yes, when your head's up, but the hand has to start heads up. So if you have a third player in, you get somebody all in, that doesn't count to two heads heads up at that point. So on the river, you had just the two of you. And he also said it's not no limit at that point, so you can't just go all on, all in. You have to actually go through the mechanic of raising and re-raising and raising and re-raising.
Right.
All right. Well, about 20 minutes later, the floor came back over and he said, and okay, hey, we just talked about it, and we're going to change that decision, and we're going to keep it at the bet in three raises or four raises, whatever it was. And he said the reason is we want to be sure we prevent collusion, because it would be easy for somebody just to go all in, two buddies to go all in and chip dump to somebody, which I thought made perfect sense.
Well, at what point do you... Yeah, okay. Never mind. I was just going to say that, well, if they're chip dumping, you could chip dump at no limit, but you have to show the hand. So are you saying that they, you know, they're raising, and then when it gets to one raise left, somebody would fold? That would be a chip dump to me. If they call it, then they have to show their cards.
I guess the only difference is it's a limit tournament, so you can protect the integrity of that. We're at no limit. Obviously, by the nature of the game, you can't. And then you have to get into the, you know, the tougher decisions, you know, whether it's chip dump. I mean, here, at least you can prevent it because by the mechanics of the game. Right. Does that make sense? You know?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. But in a cash game, then obviously they wouldn't do that because it's your cash, and if you want to dump your cash to somebody, go ahead.
In fact, actually, they said that too. You're like, you know, cash game completely different, but in the tournament, we're gonna keep it to the max. And to be honest, I think I can't imagine a lot of examples where you'd get into that situation. I mean, at some point, you got to realize either you have you both have the same hand, or somebody's just gonna realize that they don't have the nuts, so they're gonna quit doing it. I would like to think that would happen in a 200-hour tournament. No one's stupid enough to be going all the way to the mat with without the nuts.
You never know.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. But another thing that one of the dealers mentioned that I thought was pretty funny, he reminded me, I'm sure I've heard this before, but I don't think we talked about it on the show. But it's a classic Omaha story, and he was saying this is the only game where you can lose money with a steel wheel. Do you know how?
I have no idea.
I know it's one of those things where, like, wait a minute, how? How can you lose money with a steel wheel? And he was right. He said if you get...
I know how. Never mind. I know how.
All right, go ahead.
Somebody has the bigger straight flush, and then someone else has the low with you, and you get quartered, right?
There you go.
I figured it out. Sorry. I wasn't thinking. I was just wanting to hear it.
Absolutely makes sense, right? Yeah. I mean, when you think steel wheel, you think you're good, and you're like... You know. So at the same time, he was telling us this story. Someone won with like eights and threes. Scooped a pot with eights and threes. And I was sitting there thinking, I mean, this is what makes this game so great, is that you could lose money on a hand with a steel wheel, straight flush, nut low, but you could also scoop the pot with ace high.
That could also make it the reason it's the worst devil's game in the history, too.
That's probably true. I actually had a hand where nobody had anything. We checked it down, and I turned over. I jokingly said, I got a pair of threes, and turned it over. And the guy there at the table says, I think that pair of threes is going to take it. And I'm like, what? And I'm looking down there, and the last guy in the hand, he didn't slow roll, but he just didn't. He's like, oh, pair of threes. I got to check my hand again. And he had actually paired the eight on the flop, on a king-queen eight flop, and didn't think anything of it at the time. And actually, maybe. But I almost scooped the pot with a pair of threes.
So what was it like, I mean, as far as the actual atmosphere and stuff? I mean, was there WPT banners everywhere? Was it, like, all official and everything? How did it feel?
No, this was just the regional. To be honest, it felt just like a normal tournament, other than, of course, they had the WPT table felts there and stuff.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, you know, I asked them, because Hard Rock Tampa is in the middle of an expansion now, if people don't know. It's going to become the largest casino in the United States when it's done. And, you know, I was talking about the capacity, and, you know, they have 50 tables in the room now. And I'm like, hey, you know, are you eventually going to do a televised Hard Rock, WPT event here like they do down in Hollywood? And he's like, ah, no, I just don't see it in the cards. We just don't have the room for it. Got 50 tables, and there's nowhere on property that we can add tournament tables. There's no ballroom. There's no other space without taking out slot machines, which they're not going to do. Most casinos would never do that, though some do. And so I'm like, you know, and even an expansion? He's like, no, the expansion is going to be all slot machines.
Holy cow.
So they, absolutely impressive to think about the money they can make off the slot machines. And unfortunately for us poker players, you know, we don't get anything out of this.
They really think they're going to be bigger than Foxwoods? I mean, really?
Oh, by square footage, they will. That's you know, I read that in the plans.
Holy cow!
Yeah, but I mean, it will be different than Foxwoods. Obviously, it's going to be mostly. I mean, it's already mostly slot machines, and all the additions are going to be slot machines. So, yeah. Certainly the largest slot casino.
Yeah.
Anywhere.
Wow, that's going to be massive. Because I mean, you know, you go to Foxwoods, it's like a mile from one end to the other now.
Yeah.
As far as the property and everything, it's crazy.
Now, that's, of course, that's in terms of gaming space.
Yeah, gaming space, I know. It's just still, it just seems like, you know, wow, that's going to be huge.
But no, they were real excited. They had good turnouts for the three tournaments previous, and I can only imagine their main event is actually $2,500, which is about $1,000 cheaper than the main event was up in Jacksonville that I drove up for last week, and they got nearly $400 for that. So, you know, they could easily get $500 for this thing, so.
Man.
WPT brand is a strong one now, I think.
Yeah, I guess it's catching up. Okay, our hotline is 813-448-1120. You call it, we use it, we'll give you something cool, unless we give you something cool already, like we did with Dan from Atlantic City. He's calling in. This is pretty interesting.
Hey, Scott and Chris, it's Dan up in Atlantic City, the actual real owner of Antioch Poker, the silent partner. Anyway, I've been listening to your guys' travel blogs, and... just wanted to let you know that I don't think I ever told you what I really do for a living, but I'm actually an American Airlines pilot, so I've been in a lot of those rooms, enjoy them, enjoy your trip, your travel, and let you know I've also been to rooms over in Barcelona and Paris and all over the Caribbean, so whenever you guys go overseas, start taking the magazine over there, I'll be your huckleberry for reporting on those rooms. So, but I do want to say, in light of the last week's happening with my parent company, and the filing of bankruptcy, I want you to hear it here first. From now on, whenever I play American Airlines, pocket aces, and I get them cracked, my phrase is going to be, yep, American Airlines goes bankrupt again.
Oh, I love Dan from AC. He was the one at the meetup that pretended like he owned the company.
Yeah,
he got that idiot to totally believe it.
But, you know, I'm starting to wonder if he really is an American Airlines pilot, too. I mean, you know,
maybe he's just selling his ability.
Yeah, exactly.
Just for the joke, right?
Yep, just for the joke. As a matter of fact, I own American Airlines. Yeah, that's the ticket. But that's funny. I might try that table sometime.
I'm going to say this to Dan. If he really wants to use that joke, I think he's going to have to be in full uniform.
Exactly.
Or have his little pilot hat on or something, you know.
Cause stripes.
It's just not going to work if he's going to go, hey, I'm an American Airline pilot. That's why it's funny. You have to explain the joke. It's not funny.
I like it.
He's creative there.
That's great.
All right. Well, Dan, of course, has got plenty of swag from us already. But everybody else, call the hotline at 813-448-1120. And we'll send you something great like a t-shirt from PMS Pokerware, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the Antiup store at antiupstore.com.
Jonas from Copenhagen wrote us with a three-part message. And I don't know, did you go back and forth with him a little bit? I emailed him back and forth a couple of times, so I got some stuff to say about it, but I didn't know if you had...
Yeah, I was going to, and I saw that you guys were engaged in fisticuffs. Light fisticuffs.
Yeah, no, definitely in a nice...
No, it's great. You know, I love when these folks write us and they're like, you know, hey, first and foremost, you guys are awesome. I love the show.
But here's why you suck.
But no, seriously, I love that we have listeners that are willing to point out flaws, and we certainly have our share of them. We'll not disagree with that. But he brings up three points here, and I know you discussed it with him, but I have some views too, and we'll try to get through them quickly because I think he brings up some good points.
Yeah, absolutely. This first one I think really goes more to you than me, but I'll read it for you. He says, here's one of the things that you guys always say, and you quote, I raised my 7-8 suited to have odds to draw post-flop, end quote. He says, this is a strategy that I have heard you mention many times, especially Scott, and never really questioned. This approach can never be correct. It gives you slightly better odds post-flop by cutting your implied odds in half pre-flop. That's a bad deal. Of course, It doesn't mean you shouldn't raise those hands, but you do it for different reasons. What do you have to say about that?
I am going to claim amnesia on this one. I know I've often talked about raising suited connectors, but I have no concept of pot odds, as all of our listeners will know. So I can't imagine that if I ever said that I'm doing it to have the odds to draw post-flop, that I was doing it not under the influence of alcohol or something else. I mean, you've listened to shows as I have. I mean, am I missing something? Do I say this and not realize I'm saying it?
You have said it, and I think I've said it, but what I've always said it to and was that in limit, I will, if I'm on the button and it hasn't been raised to me or it's been some callers or whatever,
limit, yes.
And I'm on the button with suited connectors, I like to raise, which I know you do too, yeah. Because then everyone puts in one more bet, and now after the flop, you'll have the right odds to draw to your hands should they hit the flop correctly, fit or fold kind of thing. So I think we've talked about that. And no limit hold'em. I think you may have said that before, I don't know, but I wouldn't raise with suited connectors to increase my pot odds after the flop. I raise the suited connectors and limit hold them. So.
Yeah, certainly if I've said that, I certainly didn't mean it. Yeah. I guess it's my mea culpa, because that, again, like I said, I mean, my big weakness in the game is not being able to properly figure my odds anyhow, so I would never be so pompous as to say you need to do this to improve your odds.
And I think I said that to him too, was that if Scott did say it on the show, I think it's just because he was thinking of his limit background, and that's when he goes into automatic, you know, I will raise a suit of connectors and limit in position because I'll have position later and I'll have the right odds because everyone will call, you know, my min raise and I'll have a ton of bets in the pot already. So I think that was, if that's why he said it, because he's fallen back on his limit background, but I don't think he ever means it, no limit. So, you know, if we have said it, hey, you know what? Try doing 7 years of shows in a row and getting everything right.
Try doing 7 years of shows and getting anything right.
Exactly.
But no, great for pointing that out. Now I'll be overly uber sensitive to it in the future.
Yeah.
In fact, actually, I'm just going to fold all my suited connectors from now on. So. All right, well, the second one, and I definitely got stuff to say about this. I know you do, too. He says, quote, in that tournament, you get like 10,000 chips to start. That's a lot. How can you discuss the structure in tournaments without mentioning where the blinds start at?
Yeah, he makes a good point. And I think that we're guilty of assumption. And we all know what that does. I think that we always assume that the blinds started at 25 and 50. And if they didn't, then the person writing in about the 10,000 chips, or if we were bringing it up, then it would be an abnormal thing, and abnormalities are brought up. So if it was something like the blinds are 100 or 200, they would have been mentioned in the email to us or the letter to us, the phone call to us, because it's so abnormal. And then he responded to me saying, oh, okay, well, I'm not from the United States. Where I play, it is very rare to have 25-50 be the usual starting. He said, I play where it's 10-20. Sometimes it's 100-200. You just never know. And so he was assuming that everywhere it's like this. Whereas everywhere you and I play, blinds always start at either 25-25 or 25-50. You know, so
usually.
So when you get 10,000 chips, we're just assuming it's 25-50. But it makes a good point, though. I guess it's not the same everywhere. So if the blinds are given, we should know. A lot of times it's not given, too. That's the other thing. So how do we know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. A couple things I'll add to this, too, is, you know, it makes obviously a good point, but and I think everybody out there listening knows that it doesn't really matter. You don't get enough information based on the starting chips and where the blinds start at. You also need to consider the structure.
Yeah.
You know, if the blinds go up every 5 minutes and they double each time, that's a very fast tournament. So it's not just that. So I'll point that out in case people are chomping at the bit to add to our misery here.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess the next thing I would say is, we get this often with some of our frequently lovable, huggable critics that we don't fully explain a concept when we're throwing it out. And my defense on that always is that you're always kicking me for the show being 2 hours as it is.
I know.
Every week. So if we actually said to stop and fully explain what we mean by everything we say, we'd get like two concepts in every show.
Yeah.
Or the show would be 6 hours. So, and I'm not trying to say that we should just cut corners and that's why. But I mean, I think we – there's a level of assumption that I think listeners need to take when we're pointing out that it's based on the information we have, and there might be some other stuff beyond it that could affect it. But we're trying to get the generalities out there in a show and still have lots of good topics and keep it under 2 hours.
And when we gloss over something that was important and we didn't realize it, somebody lets us know. And if we agree with them, we put it on the show like we're doing
right
now.
That's true.
I mean, we always bring it up and say, or we every once in a while we have one of those refresher shows saying, you know, you guys are throwing around terms like, you know, Broomcorn's uncle. What the hell does that mean? You know, I'm not going to tell anybody if they don't know right now. Let them call in and ask. But anyway, so we always try to do revisits on things like that, too. So, yeah, if you feel like we're doing something wrong, always let us know. We're always open to constructive criticism and changing.
And I guess I'll say the final thing on that, too, real quick, is that even in that scenario, it's still early in the tournament.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's 25, 50, 50, 100, even 100, 200 with 10,000 ships, that's still you've got a lot of play, regardless of what the structure is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are times that the whatever we're talking about is applicable to all, regardless of the structure. So, just keep that in mind. All right, well, the third one I'll do here, I'll read it because this is completely you, because I am never going to be, never have, never will be caught dead in this game. But he says, Chris said, quote, if someone online made it 15 to go in a 1-2 game, I would sign off immediately. Why? If it's bad, that's good, right?
What I said to him was, you know, online games tend to play big already, or bigger than their limits show.
Absolutely.
And when I play online, I don't have my full bankroll online. So if I'm playing, I'm giving it a shot or whatever. If somebody's making it 15 to go online, which when I played online, it never happened. You played 1-2, the biggest somebody would raise to preflop as the first raiser, the biggest would be like $758 or something like that. I mean, but when you're playing in real life poker, people make it 20, 25 to go in a 1-2 game like it's nothing. That's 10% of your stack.
Yeah.
You know, if you're starting with 200 or whatever. So when I'm online, you know, my money online was finite, and it wasn't like I was gonna, for me to go back into my checking account to get more money moved. Maybe the third party guy was trying to sell me flowers this time instead of real money. I know. So, you know, I just was real careful. So, yeah, I mean, I guess the answer to that is you shouldn't be playing the 1-2 game then. But really, I was comfortable with if I had like a $300 or $400 bankroll, I was comfortable playing 1-2, you know, with one bullet or whatever. And then if they were playing for $6 raises, somebody's playing for $15, $20 raises, yeah, sure, it's juicy if I feel like I'm better than the player. But for the most part, people making those kind of raises, I'm getting out of there because I don't have the bankroll to make a mistake.
Yeah.
So that was why I meant that. And I didn't say I sign off immediately. What I meant was I would just change tables because it just there's no way I could play at that table. Huh?
You'd wait till your blinds come around.
Yeah, but you know what I mean. I can't afford that bankroll if I only have 400 online or something. You know, in the end, when it was getting real dicey there, I refused to keep a lot of money online, if any at all, because I was worried about what was going to happen, you know? So I didn't have a lot of cash online, and when I did play, and toward the end, too, I was playing more like 25-cent, 50-cent games because I just didn't have the bankroll. But yeah, $15 raise online was huge to me, and it was huge to everybody. I don't know anybody who played in games who said, yeah, the normal raise. How many times have we had, you know, hands of the week where they were playing 1-2 in a limit online and the raise was 15 preflop? Never.
Yeah.
So that was what I meant by that. But he also said, Chris always says that. I'm like, I have never uttered that phrase in my life until that show came up. And so he's like, okay, you're right. We're going back and forth. You're right. You probably haven't said that. But I just was – I was on a roll or whatever you say it. So, but, yeah, I don't always say that, believe me.
All right, Jonas, we appreciate you pointing out what we could do to make the show better. And even though you sent us three things, we're only going to send you one piece of swag because we're vindictive like that. But we'll be happy to send you a download of the Poker Hand Breakdown Pro, a hand history analysis program for single or mixed games from element26.net.
All right, let's call the floor. It comes from AMP88 via our magazine forum at andy@magazine.com/forum. It says, we're playing in a multi-table tournament in the early stages. In this hand, three players are down to the river. Player A and B are friends while C is new to the room. Player A is first to act and bets. Player C is in middle position and calls. Player B raises. Player A calls the raise and player C folds. Player A shows a flush while player B shows two pair. The player next to player B, who was not involved in the hand, says to player B, "I saw what you did. Don't do that again." Everyone was wondering what this person did. It was revealed that player B held up two fingers. Should the floor have been called?
All right, Jody, very short and distinct answer. Absolutely. Anytime anyone suspects collusion or foul play, it should be dealt with immediately.
Absolutely. Yeah, not much more to say there, is there?
it's much harder when they're not being so overt about it. Because then you get suspicions and it's a little tougher. But yeah, somebody's showing two fingers and communicating some way, that's terrible. It's absolutely brutal.
Yeah.
And should be dealt with. And, and if they don't deal with it, then you should leave that room. You know, I'm not going to play in a room where people are allowed to cheat openly.
Yeah, that's crazy.
All right, well, I love this. We got a couple of feedbacks on some recent shows and haven't had a chance to get them on the show. But this one comes from Brian BitGuru is his online name. And he'll be joining us on the Antioch Poker Cruise on Saturday. I'm looking forward to seeing him again. And he wrote in when we were talking about strip poker. And he said, "Hey, I listened to last week's podcast, but I had a question about the strip poker story. How does one actually play strip poker if you want to be serious about it? Can you bluff, or is there at most one piece of clothing at risk each hand? And if you win a hand, in quotes, do you accumulate extra clothing? Inquiring minds want to know."
Well, a couple of funny things about this. One, serious and strip poker have never been in the same sentence ever. So, Brian, congratulations on that. Two, it's not called bluffing. It's called buffing.
Ah, very nice. Very nice.
But I really thought this was a very interesting question because I would think that you should play it like actual chips. Clothing is actual chips. So that would make it much more exciting. You know, if you... You know, you want to keep raising because you want somebody to take their clothes off, you know, and put them in the pot. You're free to, once you win it, to put the clothes back on and put on other clothes, you know. But yeah. I do think that if you win the clothing, you accumulate extra clothing and you can put it on. Because why? What's the point? You only play like five hands then.
You know, we'll have to send that to Jody to get a ruling.
And when he says, "Can you bluff, or is there at most one piece of clothing at risk each hand?" I would think that there has to be at least one piece of clothing. It has to be blind. Say, "Hey, you only got underwear left on. You got to put it in the middle, buddy."
it's a big blind.
Yeah, that's a big blind. Or in your case, a small blind. But but really, right? Shouldn't that? I mean, you have to play like they're real chips. Your clothing is your denomination, and if you win it, you could put it on and wear it. And if you lose, you don't, and someone else could put it on and wear it. So, you know, or put it in the pot. But the thing I want to know is, like, is something worth more than other things? Like, or is underwear worth more than a shirt or a sock, you know?
Well, of course the underwear is, because now you're getting into the good stuff.
So if somebody says, "Okay, I raise you underwear," then if you don't have underwear, can you put two socks in, or are you all in automatically? You know what I mean? So there's a lot of...
Oh, my gosh. You have never played strip poker in your life, have you?
No, of course
not.
You've never
seen Three's Company when Larry took it all.
I remember he left with a pillow, though. I think he borrowed
and,
Mr. Furley's pillow.
Mr. Furley had that cowboy hat.
Yeah. Come back, Lana.
No, you're right. Big Roo is being a little too serious about it. Because here's what happens in every strip poker game that I have heard of. I do not speak from experience. Wink, wink. There is no guy that wants to win in strip poker. The object of strip poker is to get everybody get naked as quickly as possible. So obviously you wouldn't just understand it. There's a different goal here than when you go to your local casino and play your one single game.
So are you saying that all strip poker games end in an orgy?
No. Hey.
I'm trying to figure out why everyone wants to get naked. Why would you want to be naked in this game?
Hey.
Isn't the goal to get the girls naked if you're a guy, and if you're a girl to get the guys naked? Or
jumping to conclusions that I didn't put out there.
I'm rushing to judgment.
I'm just saying that there's a goal in people's minds, and it does not involve being clothed. So,
see, I gotta disagree, man. I gotta disagree. If I'm playing strip poker, my goal is to see the women naked. And if I'm seeing them naked, that means I'm not naked because I'm uncomfortable taking my clothes off. But if I want to be naked in front of these people, I'm assuming then that they're going to have sex. Because why else be naked and want to be naked in front of someone, right? I don't understand.
Wow. Wow. Trust me, I'm never taking you and Big Guru out with me on the town. All right? You guys are just anchors. I think it's best that we move on now before we fracture this relationship that we have here. All right, well, speaking of housekeeping, I guess it'd be interesting to clean up.
Pick up all the clothes that we want.
After that party. One more reminder that the Windy City Poker Championship is coming up. If you live in or near Chicagoland, don't miss this year's championship in Countryside, Illinois, featuring the Anti-Up Chicago Poker Championship. And a chance to win an Anti-Up Poker Cruise package, call 708-935-2861 for all the details.
And of course, cruise. How could you forget about our cruise? I mean, that's the only thing on your mind right now, other than trying to get naked for other people.
That was never on my mind.
Be sure to check out our 2012 Poker Cruise schedule at AntiUpMagazine.com/cruise. Yes, we have three great cruises next year: March 17th out of Tampa, August 27th out of Port Canaveral, and November 10th out of Baltimore. Now let's see what is happening.
Already.
Our Anti-Up News Desk.
LIPS, the Ladies International Poker Series, has announced the U.S. Ladies Poker Championship Circuit Tour will have 12 stops this year across the country. It kicked off this past week at Chalk Towers out in Oklahoma.
Yeah, I was wondering when someone was going to do that. Maybe we should have started our own tour and done it before them, you know.
Well, I guess they've done it for a couple of years, but this is the first time it's actually moving from different stops.
Yeah, exactly.
It was all in one place, so kudos to them.
I like it called Circuit Tour. I like that. Gamblers in Maine are mere months away from being able to play table games, including poker. Hollywood Slots in Bangor will add 14 tables or table games as early as March. A casino in Oxford plans to open in June with 10 table games. How many of each casino's table games will be for poker has yet to be announced.
Yeah, and obviously if they only have 14 and one and 10 in the other, we're not expecting Foxwoods like.
No.
Poker rooms here, but hey, you know, at least you got an opportunity to play there.
Well, when it says table games, they mean 14 different varieties of table games, or they just mean 14 tables?
Just 14 tables total.
Okay, yeah. So, probably just a handful.
Yeah. Alright, and finally, the $1 million buy-in tournament that will be part of next year's World Series of Poker has 22 entries so far, including Johnny Chan, banker Andy Beal, and three satellite winners. More entries are expected before the tournament, which raises money for world causes, starts in July.
Yeah, that's I saw that story earlier, and wow. When I looked at some of the other people that might be playing, I thought, how could you really afford $1 million?
Yeah, well, backers.
It's got to be backers, you know. But the other thing, too, if it's for charity, then I'm sure a lot of that money is...
Well, know, I think it's 10% of it, so 10%. I think about 100, roughly 100 K of each buy-in goes to the charity. So it's still 900,000 minus whatever the entry fee is.
Right.
In there, so somebody's gonna be walking around pretty rich.
So that's already $2.2 million for the charity, so that's pretty good.
Yeah, and wow, you know, it might be it'd be interesting to see how many more people they get, but it could be the richest tournament ever.
Yeah,
you about Jamie Goldwyn and what he won $12 million or so.
Yeah, you're right, that's true. Jeez.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. Ante up, because we're playing some stud. Of the high-low variety, that is. Seven players at our table were the youngest by about 97 years, and they all play loose passive. Perfect for us, actually. Our plan is going to be to wait for a hand and value bet these suckers to death. We're playing 4-8, and we're at a seven-handed table. Excuse the redundancy. We look around the table and see the King of Spades, King of Diamonds, Nine of Diamonds, Ace of Spades, Five of Spades, Queen of Clubs. I know it's hard, but try to keep up. And we have the Three of Diamonds showing, and the Ace of Diamonds, Two of Diamonds in the hole. Wow. We're bringing it in, and we've got ourselves a monster. We complete the bet to $2, hoping someone will raise. Oh, did I mention we're short-stacked again with 125? We watch as the King of Spades folds, the King of Diamonds completes our bet to $4, the Nine of Diamonds folds, the Ace of Spades calls, the Five of Spades folds, and the Queen of Clubs calls. This is exactly what we wanted. We raise it to $8 and watch as the rest of the table calls our raise. Is this too good to be true? Well, anyway, the pot is $39, and the King of Diamonds gets the Five of Clubs, the Ace of Spades gets the Queen of Diamonds, the Queen of Clubs gets the Seven of Hearts, and we pick up the Ace of Hearts for a pair of aces. The Ace of Spades, Queen of Clubs, is first to act, and he leads out into the pot for $4. The Queen of Clubs, Seven of Hearts, gets out of the way pretty quickly, and it's up to us. Normally, we'd raise here to see just how strong our opponent is, but since we're the only player left in this hand with any kind of low draw, we want that third player in for insurance purposes, in case we don't scoop, since we know the bettor doesn't have another ace. Maybe he has four Broadway cards. We simply call, as does the King of Diamonds, Five of Clubs. The pot is now at $51. The King of Diamonds, Five of Clubs, gets the Six of Spades. The Ace of Spades, Queen of Diamonds, gets the Eight of Diamonds. And we get the Six of Hearts. We're in pretty good shape here. What's more, the Ace, Queen, Eight checks. This decision is clear. We've got to start building a pot, especially with the limits now going up. We bet $8, and once again, both players just call. Pot is now at an even $75, and sixth comes down like this. The King of Diamonds, Five of Clubs, Six of Spades gets the Four of Hearts. That might be another low draw. The Ace of Spades, Queen of Diamonds, Eight of Diamonds gets the Queen of Spades, and we get the Six of Clubs. Well, that's two pair, but now the queens lead into us. Are we calling this down, or are we still trying to build a pot?
All right, first of all, I got to say, I love having the stud on a Mally's move. I do not like trying to transcribe all the cards, and I'm sure the people that listen to us in the commute are probably pulling their hair out.
Yeah.
Trying to follow. But hey, style points for trying, but... All right, on this hand, I think our hand got, obviously our hand just got a lot less awesome.
Yeah.
We have two pair, which may not even be good now that our passive opponent bet into us. We also don't yet have a low, and our other opponent might have picked up one or at least a draw to it. At this point, I'm just not going to get into a raising war on the come with just one card left. I'll call here, hope to boat up and scoop this, and if I don't boat up, maybe I'll get a low. My low will be good. Or maybe I'm just wrong, and my two pairs good too. But I certainly don't feel confident enough to raise and then watch somebody re-raise me and then re-raise again.
Very good. And at first he threw me off too because he said he completed early in the hand.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah.
He had just brought it in, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners thought he completed for the full four, but he didn't. He just brought it in for two, and just used the wrong word there. And I was glad that he did too. I wouldn't want to complete there. I'd want being the only low card up. You know, like that, yeah. Or whatever. I'd like to, and have him such a strong starting hand. I'd like to get as many people in as possible and then scoop it. So, in the end, like you, I don't like the raise as the queen paired as door card could easily mean trips, and the pot's big enough. So, and there's always a chance too that we don't make our low. So we have to hope our two pair is good. And like I said, if he has trips, we're pretty much drawing to whatever, very slim outs. And like you said too, we had that backdoor low creeping in behind us. So. I would hate to be second both ways, you know, second best both ways. So I'm merely just calling and hoping I don't get whipsawed by two people who have me beat. And yeah, like you mentioned too, I think stud eight hands are terrific. It's my favorite game, but probably not the best thing for this segment. I mean, I could just see thousands of people swerving in the traffic trying to write down all these cards and stuff. So I think that we should probably let O'Malley know that Hold'em and Omaha are probably the best way to go for the O'Malley's move. Let's listen to part two, and then we'll have our final thoughts.
Hello again. Well, under normal circumstances, we'd probably just call. But since our astute observations are running on high gear, we noticed the third player in this hand grimaced at the bet and has lost all interest. He's probably going to fold anyway. We've got to define our opponent's hand. Since the Queen of Clubs has been folded, it's unlikely he's tripped up. But we've got to be certain. We make it $16 to go, and the King 5-6-4 insta-mucks his hand, while the Queens checks his whole cards and makes the call without much deliberation. Does he have four diamonds? The pot is now at 107, and we watch our opponent carefully look at the down and dirty. He notices us observing him, and once he does, he quickly puts in another $8. Meanwhile, we get a meaningless two of clubs. Three pair isn't worth much. Why the quick bet when he caught us trying to get a read on him? Is he trying to intimidate us out of the pot? He's got to know it's unlikely that we've got a third six, since our third wheel already 86'd one of them. Perhaps he's betting his own two pair, and if that's the case, we're golden. We know he doesn't have another ace buried, but he's trying to represent it. Either that or another queen, and we know that's unlikely. I can't believe I'm going to say this, but we're going to put in a little value bet here, and we make it $16 to go. Our opponent instantly raises it to $24. Better stud players would probably cap it in this situation, but we're fine with the $155 pot, and there is a chance our read is off. We simply call, and to our delight, our opponent tables queens and eights. We show our three pair, being careful not to slow roll, as we don't want any enemies here, and we rake in a nice pot. Until next time, this is O'Malley saying, see, money can be made a limit, and I hope to see you on the felt.
Oh, I think it's definitely less than how important observation is in stud. I mean, it's everything, to be honest.
Yeah.
You know, you got to keep track of all those door cards, what's been folded, what's not there. Especially in stud 8 because you got highs and lows going. On paper, I think this hand plays out differently, but by watching our opponents, obviously he got good reads on them both and played accordingly. That's just hard to come through on the audio clip, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's all the more reason to play live when possible for that kind of information because so much is given out. I mean, I saw it at Foxwoods this past weekend. You could just see people's reactions to cards and even looking at their whole cards and stuff. It's totally different. There are, of course, benefits to playing online, Stud 8, because all the cards are within a 12-inch circumference, you know, whatever, and it's so easy to see them all and keep track of them all and whatever, but, you know, in live, whenever I play Stud 8, I'm almost always sitting on my knees on the chair and, like, leaning on the table looking at all the cards because it's such a pain, but the people's reactions are priceless and it saves you bets. I definitely would have just called there. Check call the rest of the way.
Yeah, the other thing, too, I mean, you made a good point. I mean, online, it's a lot easier to write down the cards and keep that information with you, which is a huge advantage. But you do miss that physical,
yeah,
which I think is even more important than in Hold'em because in stud, I mean, you can get a good look, you know, when there's a flop, you know, it's tough to see everybody's reaction because the flop comes out at the same time. You can't look in everybody's eyes at the same time.
Yeah.
But instead, you can watch them as the cards are dealt, you know, assuming people cooperate with you and look at the cards right away.
Yep.
You can start to get a read on everybody as the cards move around the table. Yep. And online, obviously, you're never going to get that.
That's a great point.
Of course, then again, we can't play online anymore, so why keep talking about it so much?
This is Noah Brunson, and you're listening to Annie Up.
All right, Chris, I thought some of our road trips were borderline crazy, but I wonder how many special collector's editions of Rounders I'm going to need to buy you to get you to spend 3 weeks in a car with me visiting 125 poker rooms in 35 states.
There aren't enough copies in Hollywood, buddy.
Well, that's exactly what Annie Up's Reno ambassador, Cordo Howard, did, and he didn't even need the Rounders. He just did it. You can read all about this crazy trip and the December issue of Ante Up, which is in more than 300 poker rooms right now, so go pick up a copy or download it at anteupmagazine.com. But we absolutely had to have Cordell on the show here to tell us more about it. Thanks for joining us, Cordell. I hope you've rested up from that long trip.
I sure have. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Excellent. All right, easy first question. Why? Why would you do something like this?
Why would I do something like this? Well, you know, about a year ago, I took my first trip to Sacramento to play in some poker games away from the Reno area, and I found that the games there were much easier, and it kind of made me think of all the games I was missing out on in the rest of the country, and I decided the best way to find out what I was missing was to go play them myself, and I decided someday I would want to play in every room in the country.
Well, you know, we mentioned some of these stats, the amount of states and things like that, but why don't you fill us in with some of the ones that we didn't mention, like how many miles you actually drove and how much this cost you?
let's see, I think I drove a total of about 12,000 miles in about 25 days. The total cost of the trip and expenses was roughly $1,700.
Wow.
And that was gas and, you know, food and hotel.
Well, how many, did you stay in a lot of hotels or was it, did you get comps at all? How'd that work out?
You know, I had a few comps saved up along the way, and places like Tunica and Biloxi, you know, I used my comps for hotels, but for the most part, my only expense was the gas.
Wow.
So, did you have to pull over a Jiffy Lube a couple times to get an oil change?
You know, I did a real number on the car before I left, and I actually made it through the whole trip with no problem.
Oh, my God.
Excellent. All right, well, I was excited because I was following your trip. You were sending us email updates. You were updating your Facebook page. So I was following you around as you're going. But I was ecstatic that you actually made it down here to Tampa where we are. I got to go over to Seminole Hard Rock and chat with you for about a half an hour before you had to hit the road again. But that's when I learned that you were essentially living out of your car on this trip. Now, you know, Chris just asked, you had a couple hotel comps. But you know, you were, like, showering at truck stops and stuff, right?
That's right, that's right. That was a new experience for me as well. I basically, looking at the trip, I thought it would be the most cost-efficient way was to spend a few nights in the car and shower at the truck stops. And once I started doing it, I found it, you know, very convenient for the trip I was on. You know, I could play late into the night and, you know, go crash in the parking garage or a truck stop and then wake up, hit the road, and get to the next place.
That's great.
Now, I noticed it was an SUV. It looks like it was a Honda or a Toyota RAV. Was it? Did you put the seats down and lay down in the car? Is that how it worked out?
You know, I invested in some mattresses, I guess, and sleeping bags and pillows, and I have my own little hotel room inside there every night and pack it up every day and keep moving.
That is cool. You know, some of the best things that we experience when Scott and I travel from all these poker rooms is how each region differs from the other ones that we visited. Did you experience that too? And maybe you could tell us some of the differences you noticed.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everybody goes a little different. I noticed in general, the middle of the country was kind of some of the worst games in the poker world. You know, smaller games. And as you headed east, I noticed the players get a lot more talkative, a lot more aggressive, but just really, you know, a lot more fun back east, a lot more conversation at the table, and I really enjoyed the pace of the games on the East Coast. It seemed like the dealers, the players, everybody was really playing a lot faster out there. And as I headed to the south, I noticed the games kind of slowed down a little. And I guess I noticed the closer you get to the big cities, New York, you know, San Francisco, L.A., the games tend to be juiciest.
Interesting. All right, well, our listeners love hearing about all the characters that we run across on our travels. I got to think in 12,000 miles, you ran across quite a few yourself. Any of them that you want to tell us about?
I mean, there's so many, it's hard to say just one. You know, I met a few real colorful characters when I played Foxwoods. Can't remember the guy's name, but he was just like a character out of Rounders or something. It's a KGB-style guy.
Oh, my God.
I met a real interesting guy in southern Indiana, of all places, in a, you know, a little riverboat called Casino Aztar. This guy's name was Fish. And I thought that was a great poker name. So we were playing 1020 Omaha, and you know, I just watched this guy play every hand for about 6 hours, and you know, eventually end up with all the money. And just a real interesting guy. I learned a lot from.
You know, I noticed when I read the story that you sort of, your limits are sort of all over the place, from really big Omaha games to medium to even small no limit games. Is what do you prefer, and was that also like a reason because there were no other games to play that day? Were you just a victim of the circumstances, or did you choose to play those limits?
Oh no, for me it's really a game selection thing. You know, I wouldn't play a game if I didn't think it was worth playing. So you know, if I was playing PLO, that's because I felt it was the best game for me to play at that point, the best way for me to make money.
Okay.
So my game choices were, you know, based on a $2,000 bankroll that I kind of gave myself, but if things did go wrong, I had enough backup to keep trucking.
All right, well, when we're traveling, we always see stuff along the way that we like to pull off and visit, but we're always on such a strict time schedule that we can't. It looks like you were able to work in some stops. I think you stopped at Graceland, among them. How important was it for you on this great poker voyage to break it up with some non-poker stops?
You know, I thought it was really important. I think balance is a real big part of playing poker. You know, it's not just spending all your time in a card room. You know, I didn't know how many opportunities I was going to have to see the country, so while I was in any given area, I tried to make the most of it. I remember, you know, visiting Niagara Falls after a big losing session, and you know, going to Washington, D.C. after a long day of driving, seeing the Capitol, and places like the Alamo, and, you know, it was just really fulfilling for me to be out there on the road and be able to see the country, you know, on my own time. It really helped with the overall attitude of the trip.
What did you think about the basement at the Alamo?
You know, I got to the Alamo actually probably like 7 a.m. in the morning one day, you know, after waking up at dawn, and it was closed. So.
I guess another question, too, is did you just play it by ear, how long you stayed at each poker room, or did you have kind of a predetermined schedule where, you know, hey, I'm going to play 2 hours and then move on?
Yeah, you know, I had a schedule of places I intended to go, you know, making my last stop every night hopefully the best place to play. But I really let the games dictate where I went and how long I played, you know. If I doubled up real quick, it was usually time to hit the next one. If the game was no good, you know, I'd just get on the road and go to the next one. If I was too far down the list, you know, I didn't feel like waiting, I just went to the next one. And most nights, though, I planned like at Foxwoods or the Borgata, you know, I'd plan a whole night there and play there till the games broke, basically.
What, two things. One, what was your favorite place throughout this whole trip? And then also, would you recommend this to anyone?
My favorite place, you know, it's so hard. There's a lot of great rooms out there. I think definitely the Borgata stood out for me. I was just the biggest, kind of most grandiose poker room I had seen, you know, compared to the Bellagio, the Venetian, and just made those places look a lot smaller than
right.
I remember. Would I recommend this to anybody? Anybody that likes to travel, you know, anybody that likes adventure, you know, I think it's a great way to use poker to, you know, do something, go see the country, you know. I got a lot out of it. I definitely recommend it to anybody.
And I'm sure some of our listeners are probably asking, how did this guy get 3 weeks off to do this? your real job's
miracle.
A dealer, right?
So. Yeah, I'm a poker dealer, and you know, my employer was nice enough to grant me 3 weeks off, and for that I was, you know, eternally grateful. And I just felt, given that opportunity, I had to make the most of it.
Now, I know that part of this also was your chip collection. How big is it now, and are you missing any other rooms that you really want that you didn't visit?
You know, my collection's probably about 700-odd chips. I collect a dollar chip from all the places that Spread hold them. I like to get a $5 chip from the places that Spread 5-10 the limit games are bigger. And I like to get $2 chips from the places that Spread Omaha or Seven Stud or Mixed Games.
Wow.
And, you know, through collecting, I found there's about 515-some-odd poker rooms in the U.S. And at this point, I'm only missing about maybe 20 or 30.
Wow.
Most of those are Minnesota, Wisconsin area that I just haven't made my way to yet.
Okay. Hey, you couldn't fit that into this trip?
Yeah, you know, cuts had to be made.
Okay, how did you go about planning the route? Because one of the things I thought was most interesting was when you stopped, when I caught up with you in Tampa, you were obviously up in the East Coast, and then you came all the way down through, I think, like Mississippi, and then backtracked over to Florida, which when I saw the map that, by the way, my partner Chris here did a phenomenal Google map that's in the issue this month to see it, and it made sense at that point, but when you're telling me, I'm like, wow, that's crazy, he went out of his way.
Yeah, I mean, my goal was to visit all the rooms that I had not been to before. And, you know, for weeks I would sit here and plan these trips where I would, you know, fly into a place and go in a circle with a rental car and see all the places I could in a few days. And
been there and done
what
that.
I did was, yeah. What I did is I just combined, you know, several trips together into one big, long road trip. And, you know, if you know the poker world, there's no rooms between Atlantic City and Florida.
Yeah.
So I just took the what I call the poker route to Florida. Getting room to room.
How long did it take you to get back on a normal schedule? I mean, when you got right back home, did you go to work the next day? Did you take some time, or what was the deal?
You know, it's funny. I drove right into town. I had to, you know, shave. You know, I've been growing a beard for 3 weeks. I had to shave and cut my hair all in about a half hour and run right into work and jump right back into a dead spread, you know.
Oh, my God.
It was a very big adjustment to come back.
Now, I know from my visit to Reno that you kind of have a reputation up there for people that know you like to do these crazy trips, so it's probably not too shocking to people that know you well, but have you got some other reaction from people that didn't really know you had this travel streak in you on how crazy this whole trip was?
Yeah, it's been a real positive experience for me. A lot of people have taken interest in what I've done, and you know, a lot of people now tend to come to me and ask where they should play when they travel, and I'm happy to oblige them.
Well, get prepared for being bombarded, because once they see you in the magazine, that's it. You're going to be a celebrity, so.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Well, thanks for doing this for us, man. We think you're a little crazy, but we like that in our ambassadors. So thanks for taking the time to talk to us today, too.
Hey, man, you guys are my inspiration. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, man. Sure. Talk to you soon.
Hi, this is Shannon Elizabeth, and you are listening to the Anti-F PokerCast.
Okay, we're back in the situations, Chris.
Yeah, situation.
I was thinking last night that I maybe need to give up the Jersey Shore situation. Has it run its course? Is that a joke? No, it hasn't?
Not yet. I'll tell you, don't worry.
I quit watching Jersey Shore, so now I feel like it's like now out of my consciousness now, so it's almost kind of ridiculous. But all right, we'll keep it going since you think it's good.
Yeah, I'll let you know. Don't worry. That's my thing.
All right, thanks. All right, comes from Andy Castro. He's written in before, and I love when he sends in his situations. So here's his situation this week. He was on business down in South Florida and was playing in a $1, $2 no-limit table. He had bought in for $200 and worked it up to $520. Pause for Chris's reaction.
Good for you.
I got to say, worked it up to $520. That's a pretty good day at the office.
Yeah, that's more than doubling.
That's working it up.
It's almost tripled the buy-in. That's pretty good.
It's a pretty good day at the office. All right, he says, a relative straightforward ABC poker being played at this table. On this hand, he's in middle position. He gets folded to him, and he looks down at ace of clubs, queen of hearts. He raises the $7, and the button calls and the big blind calls. The button had just been moved to our table from another table and came with about $300. The big blind was a middle-aged woman who played very tight and has about $80.
Okay, well, first of all, I already want to comment that why didn't he raise to 15?
It's not online.
$7? Are you crazy? That's only 3.5x.
All right, well, the flop comes down. Ace, king, five, all hearts, giving him top pair with decent kicker and a nut flush draw. The big blind leads out for $10. Our hero calls, and the button calls as well. Now, he says, I'm not quite sure if I should have raised here. But being the big blind had been playing so tight, having flopped a flush was definitely a hand that she could have. We'll pause here for some reaction.
Well, I kind of like the smooth call, just because we've got top pair, real good kicker, nut flush, redraw. You know, I'm not really afraid, or I don't really want to thin the field here. And, you know, I mean, the only thing that we could be afraid of is the board pairing and then, you know, giving someone a flopped set, a full house or something. And then, if they got a baby flush, we're still drawing to the best flush. So I kind of like just smooth calling here and then exploding on the turn if I can.
Yeah, I mean, if we don't have that suited card in our hand, I mean, I think you want to race here just to find out whether you're – get some information on whether you're up against the flush right now. But right now, I don't really care so much.
Yeah.
You know, if their heart comes, excellent. That's beautiful. And so I have a little insurance. So, all right. So, hey, our hero's doing something right already. You know, if you believe that the two of us are.
Yeah, if we know anything what we're talking about.
All right. So the turn comes, the six of spades. So we're looking at ace, king, five, six. Remember, still three hearts out there. The big blind bets $20 into the $50 pot. Our hero again calls, and so does the button. The river is the tray of hearts, giving our hero the nuts, he says. Of course, I corrected him and said that there's a straight flush possibility there. But the big blind goes all in for $43, and our hero raises to 100. The button immediately folds. The big blind shows jack, nine of hearts, and I show the nut flush. As I suspected, she had flopped the flush. So here's his question, Chris. I was given a hard time by at least two players at the table telling me I should not have raised with the nuts as to invite a call from the button. I did not argue or remain quiet. My reasoning was that if he had a hand that could call, I wanted to get as much value as possible. I believe he was calling or folding whether it raised or not. What do you guys think the right play was on the river?
Okay, I feel like a raise is probably not the best play there because... Really, what hand can call you? The ten of hearts? I mean, the only other hand that can call is going to be the hand that beats you with the real steel wheel.
Yeah.
So you're only going to lose money. This way, if you just call, the guy could have two pair, could have the ten of hearts and just call for 30, but he's not going to call for 100 with the... Easily, the ace of hearts can be out. The queen of hearts could be out and the jack of hearts could be out. So if he had the ten of hearts... It's even almost an easy fold for $30, but it's possible that he would call with it. To me, this is how I feel. I mean, whatever. But raising, you're losing all. You know, there's no way he's going to call the 10 hearts with a $100 raise there, because you know obviously the queen of hearts is out and the jack of hearts beats you too. So and then a straight flush beats the 10 of hearts too. So there are at least three hands that beat the 10 of hearts, and if you're raising, you wouldn't do it with the 9 of hearts.
Yeah.
So you're telling that person, you know, I have better than the 10 of hearts, if that's what that person had. So I'm hoping that the guy has a set, two pair, or the 10 of hearts and can call $30, and I get $30 more. There's no way I'm getting 70 more from that guy on top of the 30 with the 10 of hearts or worse. So I don't like the raise.
Well, I think the value play here is just to call. You have the $43 in for the all-in, right?
Yep.
So you can't get any more out of that guy. And $43 is a nice little payoff on the river with the second nuts and really the only legitimate hand nuts out there. I mean, I think the straight flush is a stretch, but so to me at this point, I want to get what I can out of the other player, and I think I'm happy just calling because that's going to invite a call from the other person. I think they're like, you know, all right, he's all in now the betting shut down. I'll put the $43 in if I have the 10 of hearts or, as you said, you know, the jack of hearts or something like that.
Right.
But raising, I think you're forcing the other player out.
Yeah, I don't know why I kept saying $30. $43. Yeah. I don't know where 30 came from. But yeah, $43. There's no
reason.
You're counting
your implied odds on the preflop when you raised with Sudo Connect.
Yeah, I don't know where that 30 came from.
Yeah, I mean, so you know, I want to get us again. It's a game of poker is to extract as much value as possible, and I just don't think the raise. I mean, I think you're taking a big chance that someone's going to be able to call that money. Where, you know, the 43, I think, in a lot of ways disguises your hand a little bit. I mean, obviously, no one's stupid, and they can see the hearts out there. There's four hearts, but I mean, you know, I would think in the heat of the moment, people would think that you would raise with that hand, and the fact that you didn't, I think, almost invites the call, and then you get the $43. And, you know, maybe they'll raise you too, but I just think you cost yourself $43 there.
Yeah, I think so. At least a chance at $43.
A chance at $43,
yeah.
Yes.
Because the other way, you weren't going to get paid $100 with the nuts. You just weren't going to.
No.
So I kind of agree with the people telling them that you probably should have just called. But whatever.
All right. All right, Andy. Well, we appreciate, as always, you contributing to the show. And remind folks that if you send Hands of the Week to podcast at antiupmagazine.com, we will send you a piece of swag, including an uncut sheet of J-Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Antiup. You can only win the uncut sheets, but you can buy the cards in the Antiup store at antiupstore.com.
Well, I'd like to thank our Reno Antiup ambassador, Cordell, coming on the show and telling us about his amazing trip. I'll just never get over it. That was just remarkable.
Absolutely. Makes me want to do it.
It sort of makes me want to do it. It makes me want you to do it and then tell me how it was, and I'll think about it myself. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Antiup is a production of antiupmagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@antiupmagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.